Research credit on the following article goes to Dave, our Napa Sentinel, with a small s. And again, that's sort of a pun on my part. He is not affiliated with the Napa Sentinel, with a large S, a capital S. That is, of course, the semi-weekly paper put out by Harry Martin. And we'll be getting back to that and Harry Martin's fine work in just a minute. But Dave, our Napa Sentinel, with a small s, researched the following article from the Napa Register. That's another Napa paper. And this specifically is the Napa Register of Wednesday, May 25th, of 1988. This is a register story by Ann Stanley, S-T-A-N-L-E-Y. She's a Register staff writer, and this is headlined, Drug Probe Deep into Napa. And skipping down into the article, more on the Calvin Robinson-Christopher Boyce relationship that I touched on earlier. Calvin Robinson, 47, was once charged with participating in a string of bank holdups by a gang that included convicted spy Christopher Boyce. According to court documents, Robinson was a prison compatriot of Boyce, convicted in 1977 of espionage for the Soviet Union. Robinson reportedly went on the lam with Boyce after his sensational January 19, 1980 escape from federal prison in Lompoc, California. Boyce, portrayed in the movie The Falcon and the Snowman, was serving a 40-year sentence. Robinson was charged with harboring a fugitive and in connection with 13 Northwest bank robberies following Boyce's capture in late 1981. But the charges against Robinson were dismissed by U.S. District Attorney Judge Harold Ryan in Idaho for lack of evidence. That last sentence again. Robinson was charged with harboring a fugitive and in connection with 13 Northwest bank robberies following Boyce's capture in late 1981. But the charges against Robinson were dismissed by U.S. District Judge Harold Ryan in Idaho for lack of evidence. Boyce pleaded guilty and received 25 years for the bank robberies. Well, it remains to be seen just exactly how involved Christopher Boyce was with Calvin Robinson beyond what we've been told. At least from that article there, it suggests at least the possibility that he may have actually been involved in some of those robberies. Charges may have been dismissed, but given the national security ramifications of the case, it is within the realm of possibility that there may have been an official cover-up. Certainly, that isn't that rare in this particular case. Now, the next article that we're going to read here comes, again, from the Napa Sentinel, the small semi-weekly paper in Napa that has been doing such a magnificent job in covering this the drug tug Lenvest case. By the way, at the end of this particular update, I'm going to give you the information concerning the address and phone number for the Napa Sentinel, because they have put together a press package of all of the articles on the drug tug Lenvest case. Now, this particular case actually deals, this particular article, I should say, actually deals more with the Lenvest situation than the drug tug per se. But as we're going to see, although this deals more with a financial angle, it appears to move in the direction of national security activities and indeed with the main body, the Contra-related aspects of the drug tug case. Research credit on the following article goes to Dave, our Napa Sentinel. And once again, this comes from the Napa Sentinel with a capital S. And this is from the Napa Sentinel of Friday, October 27th of 1989. This is an article by Harry V. Martin, the star reporter and publisher of the Napa Sentinel. And it's headlined, Secret Agreement of Charles Duck. Subheaded, sealed court documents reveal how feds struck a deal with trustee. Lenvest trustee will get minimum sentence in exchange for cooperation. And again, this is a major new player in this scenario. This is Charles Duck. Not to be confused with John Duff or John Ho, although they all relate, as we shall see. The article reads in part as follows. A secret agreement was reached between the United States attorney and former Lenvest trustee Charles Duck. The agreement was sealed by the court. The Sentinel has, however, been able to obtain a copy of that sealed record. Duck, who pleaded guilty of misappropriating $1.9 million from bankruptcy creditors, has agreed to testify against several Bay Area attorneys who conspired with him. The U.S. federal grand jury is expected to issue several indictments against Bay Area attorneys. There is no indication at this point whether or not any federal judges will also be named or indicted, as Duck's agreement to testify is held behind closed doors in secret grand jury meetings. Well, again, bear in mind the agreement here between the U.S. Attorney's Office and former Lenvest trustee Charles Duck. He was involved as a trustee with the disposition of their bankruptcy. Now, turning again to the Napa Sentinel, specifically the Napa Sentinel, once again, well, this is a new issue, the Napa Sentinel of Tuesday, October 31st of 1989, we're going to learn more about Charles Duck and his interesting connections here. Once again, from the Napa Sentinel of Tuesday, October 31st of 1989, once again, the story is by Harry V. Martin. It's headlined Strange Ties, subheaded Duck's Attorney, also represents Dixon and Medellin Cartel. Dixon is D-I-C-K-S-O-N, and again, by Harry Martin, copyright 1989. The article reads in part as follows. There are many strange ties associated with the criminal indictment of former LendVest trustee Charles Duck. Although LendVest was not assigned to the bankruptcy courts until May of 1988, Duck apparently has been under federal investigation for fraud, embezzlement, money laundering, and other charges since as early as 1985. Duck has retained Peter Robinson as his attorney to represent him in the federal criminal case. Robinson, a former assistant U.S. attorney, was in the U.S. attorney's office in San Francisco when the investigation of Duck commenced. His representation has been challenged by several families hurt by Duck's handling of bankruptcies. Under federal law, USC 9207, a former U.S. government employee cannot be involved with any cases associated with his former officer for a period of 2 years after leaving office. But stranger yet, however, is the fact that Robinson also represents former LendVest Vice President David Dixon and is reported to have represented Alvaro Becerra, A-L-V-A-R-R-O-B-E-R-C-E-R-R-A, believed to be a member of the Colombian drug family known as the Medellin Cartel, which has CIA connections and direct connections to Calvin Robinson, the skipper of the drug tug. All three were accused of money laundering. Duck has been offered a light sentence for his cooperation. Dixon was offered immunity for his cooperation. Calvin Robinson was convicted. Duck's attorney insists that Duck acted alone and will not be providing information on Bay Area attorneys and possibly federal judges when he testifies before a federal grand jury. Skipping down on the story, thousands of businesses and individuals were involved with Duck in bankruptcy matters. A letter on file with the Department of Justice states that both U.S. Attorney Joseph Russaniello and Robinson, quote, were well aware of Mr. Duck's misconduct as long ago as 1985. So his attorney, that is to say, Charles Duck's attorney, Peter Robinson, against U.S. law, is representing him in a case involving his former officer, Joseph Russaniello, U.S. attorney in San Francisco, about whom we're going to say more in a minute. Significantly also, perhaps, he is involved with a reputed member of the Medellin cartel, as well as with another LendVest vice president, David Dixon. So this is an interesting connection here, and apparently, at least according to the information here, an illegal connection and quite possibly significant. Now, more here on the situation of Charles Duck, the LendVest trustee, and Peter Robinson, former assistant U.S. attorney, assistant to Joseph Russaniello, with whose office this deal was cut. More on this again from the Napa Sentinel of Tuesday, November 7th of 1989. Once again, coming to bat, Harry V. Martin, and this article is called Fooling Them, subheaded The Elusive Duck Tales Continue. I like that pun. Skipping down in the story, the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco and Santa Rosa, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the Criminal Investigation Service of the Internal Revenue Service were all asked to investigate Duck as early as August 20th, 1986. Peter Robinson, an assistant U.S. attorney, was included in the request for an investigation of Duck. Robinson is now Duck's attorney. Under federal law, a former U.S. government attorney cannot represent a client who is part of an investigation of that office for at least 2 years after the attorney has left government service. Robinson has not been out of government service for 2 years yet. Robinson also represents David Dixon, a former LendVest officer. Now, the thing that's so interesting about the connection between Peter Robinson and Charles Duck and Joseph Russaniello is that in a famous case that was, I believe, in 1986, although I'm not sure offhand of the year, a group of people were involved with cocaine smuggling, and as it turns out, there was every indication that this cocaine smuggling was going on behalf of the Contras. This became quite clear, and even though the apparent criminal conduct was beyond dispute, Joseph Russaniello, the U.S. attorney in San Francisco, turned the money, the proceeds, back over to the Contras, even though the proceeds came from a criminal investigation. Interestingly enough, although it may be apocryphal, Joseph Russinello is reported, I can't absolutely verify it, but is reported to have been the college roommate of Rudolph Giuliani, the prosecutor who, the former U.S. prosecutor who figures so prominently in the December surprise hypothesis and appears to have been a ringer in the investigation, or perhaps alleged investigation would be a better term here, of the Iran-Contra scandal. That may be totally apocryphal, but it may also represent elements of an old boy network. Certainly, those things do exist. And again, it may be totally apocryphal and irrelevant, but it may represent something of an old boy network. So it is, as I like to say, food for thought and grounds for further research. Now, the Charles Duck Lenvest angle begins to re-intersect in a big, big way with the other, with the drug tug aspect of the case. In the Napa Sentinel of Friday, November 3rd of 1989, in the small section called Up the Wall by Harry V. Martin once again, we find this little item. We have been flooded with calls, faxed documents, and express packages all about former Lenvest trustee Charles Duck. His embezzlement is so widespread, the court system may never get to the bottom of it. One report, which we have not verified as yet, is that he flew by LACSA Airlines out of Los Angeles last summer to Costa Rica. The person he reportedly flew down with and stayed with was Dr. John Duff. More later. So that at this stage of the game was unconfirmed. However, once again, the Napa Sentinel, and this time we turn to the Napa Sentinel of Friday, November 24th of 1989, once again, on page 2 in the Up the Wall section by Harry Martin, we find the following, an apparent confirmation of the Charles Duck, John Duff rendezvous. In a small section headlined, What About the Manifest?, it reads, We've told you about the report that former Lenvest trustee Charles Duck reportedly flew to Costa Rica with former Napan Dr. John Duff, who had ties with CIA-supported John Hull. Where is the manifest of those flights? Under lock and key. The manifests were subpoenaed by a U.S. congressional committee looking into the CIA involvement in drugs and arms with the Contras. Apparently, the manifests are being used to check out all the people who flew in with Ken Armitage-supplied Costa Rican passports and those with illegally obtained diplomatic passports. You will find several Napa names on those lists. So not only, apparently, is the Charles Duck, John Duff trip a factual event. In other words, it does not appear to be an unconfirmed report. It looks pretty confirmed at this stage of the game, but apparently much of the information is unavailable because the manifests have been subpoenaed by a congressional committee looking into U.S. complicity in the drug traffic. So basically, that is the next update in the Drug Tug Lenvest case. We're going to take a short musical break and then come back with a little more information possibly relevant to this, certainly dealing with the same kinds of elements. Welcome back to One Step Beyond. We're going to proceed now, and bearing in mind the information you just heard about Charles Duck, his connections to attorney U.S. former assistant U.S. attorney Peter Robinson, his less than legal relationship with Peter Robinson, we're now going to take a look at Charles Duck's connections to the Centennial Savings and Loan Failure, one of the cases that Robinson was in charge with investigating. Apparently he was not as vigorous in that investigation as he may have been. Now, bear in mind the drug tug case. Bear in mind the links, which we'll now review, to the Centennial Savings and Loan case. And in turn, bear in mind Sid Shaw and his connections to that drug smuggling operation. One of the questions we're asking, whether those are two distinct operations or whether they are, in fact, part of the same operation. Research credit on the following article, again, goes to Dave, our Napa Sentinel, and it comes from the Napa Sentinel. And this specifically is from the Napa Sentinel of November 7th of 1989. We read this particular article in the last installment. It's called Fooling Them. It's by Harry Martin of the Napa Sentinel. While bankruptcy judge Alan Yaroslavsky resisted any complaint or assault on the method by which former Lenvest trustee Charles Duck handled cases, Duck was apparently hoodwinking the courts, creditors, federal authorities, and some local media. The Napa Register and KVON, which do not have a penchant for checking out the statements and deeds of official people, bought his line about everything being okay when it was not. Duck took over Lenvest and prevented it from being declared fully insolvent.
He and his attorney racked up high fees while economic solutions for the victims of LendVest were carefully skirted. The pattern of many other cases resemble the same technique Duck applied to LendVest, from commingling of funds to direct conflicts of interest to strange bank loans and services from Redwood Bank. The U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco and Santa Rosa, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the Criminal Investigation Service of the Internal Revenue Service were all asked to investigate Duck as early as August 20, 1986. Peter Robinson, an assistant U.S. attorney, was included in the request for an investigation of Duck. Robinson is now Duck's attorney. Under federal law, a former U.S. government attorney cannot represent a client who was part of an investigation of that office for at least 2 years after the attorney has left government service. Robinson has not been out of government service for 2 years yet. Robinson also represents David Dixon, a former LendVest officer. At the time the investigation on Duck was requested, three main concerns were expressed. The appointment of Duck as trustee to property involved in legal action between Centennial Savings and Loan and the property known as Wild Oak. Once again, the appointment of Duck as trustee to property involved in legal action between Centennial Savings and Loan and property known as Wild Oak. The property owned by Duck at Wild Oak. Loans to Duck from Redwood Bank. When Duck was appointed as trustee for Wild Oak, objections were expressed because it appeared Duck was in conflict of interest, owning property in the Wild Oak Village. A federal judge ignored the complaint of conflict and appointed Duck as trustee. Duck owned three parcels at Wild Oak Village. And so, again, the legal action between Centennial Savings and Loan and Wild Oak connected to Duck, was one of the things that Duck oversaw. Now, again, some of these connections are somewhat peripheral. I'm in no way implying that the fact that there are... I'm not trying to place too much emphasis on any one of these connections, but still it is fascinating how many of the same, again, the same names and same institutions keep intersecting with one another. And in turn, again, I'm asking whether there might be some connections between the LendVest case, the drug tug case, and the Centennial Savings and Loan, and in turn between elements of the Iran-Contra scandal and the CIA Savings and Loan connection that we're looking at here. Certainly, at this point, it appears that a link is developing between some of the same elements. Whether or not the two cases wind up intersecting in an investigative way remains to be seen. But the Napa Sentinel is beginning a series on some of the links, and they're going into the CIA connection to the SNL crisis, and they're going in turn into some of the links with the drug tug case. I'm going to read you quickly, and again, these cases speak for themselves. I'm going to read you the first two of these articles in the Napa Sentinel series. The first comes from the Napa Sentinel of Tuesday, April 3rd of 1990. This is another article by Harry V. Martin. It's headlined, Bosco's SNL Ties, a New Series. A Strange Web of Indictments, Opulent Living in Two Failed Savings and Loan Companies. Editors, it's the first article in the series. Editors note, while several members of the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives are under investigation in the savings and loan scandal, the Sentinel is focusing on the SNL scandal as it impacts the local area. One such savings and loan in this area, Centennial Savings, had a history similar to that of LendVest. Several of its officials were indicted and convicted of money laundering. In the middle of the controversy is Congressman Doug Bosco. This series will focus on the savings and loans, CIA involvement, drug money, and politics. The U.S. government is facing the prospect of spending $300 billion to bail out the ailing SNL industry. I would now say that the estimate for the SNL bailout is up to $500 billion. It may eventually go higher than that. The article reads as follows. What does former LendVest bankruptcy trustee Charles Duck, former Deputy U.S. Attorney Peter Robinson, convicted drug money launderer Sid Shaw, Congressman Doug Bosco, Las Vegas casinos, the CIA, and organized crime all have in common? They can all be directly linked to the failed Centennial Savings and Loan and defunct Golden Pacific Savings and Loan. There are also interwoven into this scenario Las Vegas gambling and racketeering ties, like in LendVest and Joseph Matthews Winery, and CIA covert operations into the savings and loan industry. These interwoven connections can also be associated with the drug tug as the picture widens. Behind the big picture might have been the late William Casey, former head of the CIA. Casey is reported to have launched a plan by which funding for the Contras would come through And I'm going to turn to the article through savings and loan institutions using some of them as fronts for money laundering operations. This series will connect the failures of savings and loans in Texas and California to known CIA operatives and companies. Like in the Drug Tug series, this series will trace a step-by-step flowchart of the plot. The CIA savings and loan scandal was first reported in the Houston Post, 2 months ago. The series will probe how the CIA used key operatives to build up the assets of savings and loans as deposit brokers, how the CIA operatives are linked directly to other CIA covert activities, including illegal drug and arms shipments, how savings and loans were used, and how they suddenly collapsed. The local ties will focus on Centennial Savings, Pacific Savings and Loan, and LendVest. Key local figures, including Sid Shaw, Charles Duck, Congressman Doug Bosco, and former Deputy U.S. Attorney Peter Robinson. Organized crime's role, and their area lieutenants, the lavish lifestyles associated with the principal figures, the many victims, and last, and here's the part that interests me, and how the drug tug fits into the scenario. I would interject at this point. I'm going to read you the first two articles in this series. It should be noted that a lot of the information in the series, which has now progressed beyond these first two articles, basically duplicates things that we have already seen. So I'm not going to read the whole series because, again, there's considerable overlap and intersection with a lot of the information we've looked at before. There is obviously considerable cross-pollinization at this point between the Napa Sentinel and One Step Beyond. Continuing now with the Napa Sentinel article of 4390. Centennial Savings and Loan, by the way, there's also a lot of overlap with the information presented here and the information that we've already heard concerning Centennial. These two articles that I'm going to read will help fill out some of the details about Centennial as it applies to their operations north of San Francisco. Centennial Savings and Loan was an obscure financial institution that skyrocketed to wealth in a short period of time. The financial institution, headquartered in Santa Rosa, was seized by the federal government despite loud outcries from Congressman Bosco. Centennial Savings and Loan was found to have at least $4 million missing and $30 million in delinquent loans, as well as a portfolio of grotesquely overvalued real estate holdings and subsidiaries. The San Francisco Chronicle described Centennial in these terms. A cast of characters straight out of Dallas and Dynasty populated the Centennial saga, a tale of fast financial footwork and champagne tastes that ended in scandal and disgrace. When it only had $1.3 million in assets, it purchased the giant construction company of Piombo Corporation for $13 million in cash. The man who brokered the deal, Sid Shaw, became executive vice president of Centennial and president of Piombo Corporation. He also received 25% of Centennial's stock. Shaw was convicted for his connection with a $300 million international drug money laundering operation with direct ties to organized crime and Las Vegas casinos. Joseph Matthews Winery is also alleged to have had similar connections. Shaw became a millionaire and received an $819,000 bonus from Centennial. Shaw, a partner of Nico Sandman, S-A-N-D-M-A-N-N, bought a building for $160,000 in Santa Rosa and resold it almost immediately to Centennial for $1 million. Centennial then spent $1 million renovating the building. The Savings and Loan Institution maintained a lavish penthouse condo in San Francisco valued at $800,000 and a private jet. The Santa Rosa Press Democrat described the Centennial offices in these terms. Centennial turned the stone house into a study in opulence. There was a massive rock fireplace with a carved mantelpiece imported from Europe. Elegant antiques filled the room, and a $30,000 gold and silver chess set was kept on hand for idle moments. Centennial also threw lavish parties. One Christmas party alone cost $132,000. Each course at the lavish dinner was heralded by Roman trumpets. Congressman Bosco was a frequent guest with the use of the penthouse private jet and also the guest of honor at the lavish Christmas dinner, and received hundreds of thousands of dollars in loans from Centennial. Centennial officials were also large contributors to Bosco's election campaigns. Bosco's financial disclosure statement hid these gifts, and he once denied them. Let me read those last two sentences again. Congressman Bosco was a frequent guest with use of the penthouse, private jet, and also the guest of honor at the lavish Christmas dinner, and received hundreds of thousands of dollars in loans from Centennial. Centennial officials were also large contributors to Bosco's election campaigns. Bosco's financial disclosure statement hid these gifts, and he once denied them. Now he admits their use, and Bosco also received two loans from Centennial, one for $80,000, another for $95,000, plus Golden Pacific Savings and Loan, which had very close ties with Centennial, loaned the congressman an additional $65,000. Bosco's mother also worked for Centennial Savings and Loan. According to the Empire News, Bosco, quote, was a regular guest at Centennial's luxury penthouse condo on Lombard Street in San Francisco and availed himself more than once of Centennial's corporate plane. The San Francisco Chronicle aptly described the situation as follows. As Centennial grew, so did its network of influential friends and contacts. Public officials shared the wealth in loans, campaign gifts, and business deals with Centennial figures. Centennial's joyride lasted only a brief 2 years. The FBI conducted a wide-ranging probe of potential criminal violations, including loan kickbacks and fraud, unquote. Bosco sharply criticized federal authorities who seized Centennial. Why? Well, obviously, the implication there is that some of the connections between Bosco and Centennial, which are not only going to be reviewed in this article, we're going to go over them again in the material from Inside Job here, so that we have, just by way of providing independent corroboration for some of what Harry's talking about here. Moving now to the Napa Sentinel of Friday, April 6th of 1990, the second article in the series called Why Bosco Interceded on Centennial Savings Case. It reads as follows. Editor's note, and this again by Harry Martin. While several members of the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives are now under investigation in the savings and loan scandal, the Sentinel is focusing on the SNL scandal as it impacts the local area. One such savings and loan in this area, Centennial Savings, had a history similar to that of LendVest. Several of its officials were indicted and convicted of money laundering. In the middle of the controversy is Congressman Doug Bosco. This series will focus on the savings and loans, CIA involvement, drug money, and politics. The government is facing the prospect of spending $300 billion to bail out the ailing SNL industry. And the article's main part reads, when the Centennial Savings and Loan paper was finished, the president of the savings and loan was dead, the chief executive officer was convicted of drug money laundering, known mafia people were indicted, and officials of Golden Pacific Savings and Loan, which had close ties to Centennial, were also in jail. Congressman Doug Bosco's net worth had escalated past the $1 million mark, and a former deputy U.S. attorney had changed sides to defend criminals for high fees. Approximately $168 million is missing. What we learned of Centennial Savings and Loan was that it had widespread links to other savings and loan institutions throughout the nation, all of which collapsed and all with mafia ties. It appears that after President Ronald Reagan signed a bill in 1982 to deregulate savings and loan institutions, the mafia and the CIA found them easy targets for takeovers in use. Recall looking at the information from Inside Job, George Bush, a key player in this deregulation, George Bush, director of the CIA during part of the time the Nguyen Bank was in operation, and George Bush, of course, the person out of whose office Operation Eagle, later Operation Black Eagle, run by, among others, Misha Harari and Adler Barry Seal. Well, that cocaine operation used to finance the Contras run out of George Bush's office. Again, one wonders, the question I'm asking here, what possible relationship between Bush, the CIA, his role in deregulating the thrifts, and the use of some of the thrifts by mafia and CIA to deal with, among other things, apparently, the Contra support effort, quite possibly the Contra-related drug traffic. Anyway, continuing here with the Napa Sentinel article, in the era of the big takeover, principals of Centennial lived very opulent lives, all becoming millionaires and influencing government officials from congressmen to local sheriffs. A troika of writers, Stephen Pizzo, Mary Fricker, and Paul Muolo, described the influence in their book, Inside Job, The Looting of America's Savings and Loans, as, quote, Centennial was quick to lavish attention on Doug Bosco. Bosco's mother was given a job working at Centennial, and Sid Shaw hired a friend of Bosco's to manage Shaw's company, Lakewood Enterprises. We'll be reviewing that passage in a second. A representative of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board notified Centennial that it was being seized. Inside Job states, quote, if there was ever a moment to call in one's IOUs, that was it, and that night Centennial's favorite congressman, Doug Bosco, announced from his home in Washington, D.C., that he was outraged by the bank board's action. He said that he was concerned for Centennial's shareholders and that he knew Irwin Hansen, president of Centennial, and considered him to be a kind, generous, and humanitarian man. He said he was going to personally investigate the bank board's seizure of Centennial. The book continued, Bosco was just one of the first in a long line of congressmen and senators who would interfere with the regulatory process in the name of constituent service, end quote. Napa's congressman later had to make a hasty retreat from his Centennial support only after North Coast bankers threatened to withdraw financial support from his campaign. Bosco was later forced to make an embarrassing public retraction when a group of conservative bankers threatened to withdraw their financial support for Bosco if he did not distance himself from the likes of Irv Hansen, unquote. Bosco had received thousands of dollars in campaign contributions from Centennial-related people. Bosco's direct interference and criticism of the federal takeover was a clear case of conflict of interest. Bosco had been wined and dined, had use of Centennial's opulent San Francisco penthouse, used Centennial's private jet on more than one occasion, and even had his mother employed with the financial institutions, had friends given key jobs and loans, and was the guest of honor at a $148,000 Christmas party that Centennial hosted with trumpets and jesters, sumptuous food, and all types of favors. Bosco never reported any of these gifts or favors on his federal disclosure statement, which is a violation of federal law. At first, he vehemently denied use of Centennial's private aircraft, but later admitted its use and that he had not disclosed it. Bosco did ask the House Ethics Committee to waive a rule that he report the value of gifts he received. But Bosco's conflict extended beyond his enjoyment of his lavish Centennial host. Bosco received two loans from Centennial totaling $124,000, along with another $65,000 from Golden Pacific. Bosco was often delinquent in his payments. Bosco was able to remodel his home, buy a 10-acre horse ranch south of Santa Rosa for $480,000. He has also purchased a 100-acre hilltop estate west of Sebastopol for $1.3 million. Bosco owes the Congressional Credit Union, two banks, and a financial institution only $10,000. His congressional salary is $89,000. Sid Shaw, who made millions off the Centennial Savings and Loan scam, owned big chunks of real estate, prime land that many developers are vying for. Bosco received a 35-acre parcel adjacent to Shaw's property for $50,000. He did not declare this property either, and eventually a Sonoma County newspaper found out about it, even though the property was not registered in his name. He eventually admitted to the ownership, stating it was a very complex deal. Not only did Bosco attempt to interfere with a Centennial savings and loan closure, but he also was absent from a key vote last August when the House of Representatives voted on President George Bush's savings and loan cleanup bill. How much did Bosco know about Centennial? Did he know of mob money? Did he know of the opulent, money-draining living style of Hansen and Shaw? Senator Alan Cranston is taking a lot of heat today for his involvement in association with the savings and loan scandal. How does Bosco view that situation? Quote, Cranston shouldn't run for re-election, unquote, Bosco says. Bosco is running for re-election, however. Is there a difference? Well, again, we're very quickly going to take a look at, again, reviewing Bosco's connections to Centennial Savings and Loan and his attempts to frustrate the bank board's confiscation of Centennial. Again, this by way of shoring up the information in the Napa Sentinel. I think most of that speaks pretty directly for itself. Returning again quickly to Inside Job about Irwin Hansen or Irv Hansen and his connections to Bosco and Centennial, the tri-authors write as follows. Irv Hansen was building Centennial into a center of financial power in Northern California, but Hansen was interested in buying more than good press. Success and money always attract politicians, and Centennial attracted its share. Congressman Douglas Bosco, a Democrat, came from a small town near Guerneville where he had been a Haines family friend. A born politician, he was an attorney and a former member of the California State Legislature, where he was a member of the Assembly Finance, Insurance, and Commerce Committee. Centennial was quick to lavish attention on Bosco, and Bosco's mother was given a job working for Haines at Centennial. By the way, Beverly Haines is another of the players in the Centennial situation. Beginning again, Bosco's mother was given a job working for Haines at Centennial, and Shaw hired a friend of Bosco's to manage Shaw's company, Lakewood Enterprises. Hansen, Shaw, Haines, and various family members were listed as contributors to Bosco on his 1983 and 1984 disclosure statements. In addition, Bosco borrowed $124,000 from Centennial and $65,000 from Golden Pacific between 1982 and 1984. His payments were often late, and a thrift executive told us SNL officers had to call Bosco in Washington to discuss bringing his payments current. Bosco said the tardiness was caused by frequent moves. In 1984, Bosco used Centennial's private plane to attend the funeral of a constituent and failed to report it on his federal financial disclosure form. He said the failure was an oversight. In 1986, he was questioned by the FBI about Centennial savings, but he was not accused of any wrongdoing. An FBI agent told us that if the FBI investigated Bosco for his relationship with Centennial, they'd have to investigate all congressmen because they all did the same thing. Bosco said his relationship with Centennial was completely above board, that he never asked them for any personal favors, nor did they ever do him any. But with powerful friends, Centennial Savings' influence in the community prospered nicely. And again, nothing new there. We went over it in the last segment. We also reviewed that same information via the Napa Sentinel just a second ago. And once again, of Bosco and his efforts to bat on behalf of Centennial, the authors of Inside Job, right? And again, we've seen this before. We've read this passage in the previous installment. The Piombo sale, that's that construction company, the Piombo sale was the final outrage. At 5 p.m. on August 20th, 1985, a small army of SLIC examiners, auditors, and private security guards stormed Centennial's branches. A representative of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board walked up to Hansen, handed him a letter from Washington, and said, quote, "Mr. Hansen, we are declaring Centennial insolvent. You are hereby removed as chairman of the board and president. Please give us your keys and do not touch anything on or in your desk," unquote. If there was ever a moment to call in one's IOUs, that was it, and that night, Centennial's favorite congressman, Doug Bosco, announced from his home in Washington, D.C., that he was outraged by the bank board's action. He said that he was concerned for Centennial's shareholders and that he knew Hansen and considered him to be a kind, generous, and humanitarian man. He said he was personally going to investigate the bank board's seizure of Centennial. Bosco was just one of the first in a long line of congressmen and senators who would interfere with the regulatory process in the name of constituent service. Bosco was later forced to make an embarrassing public retraction when a group of conservative bankers threatened to withdraw their financial support for Bosco if he did not distance himself from the likes of Irv Hansen. A spokesman explained their reasoning. Quote, "My feeling is that a legislator should have all the facts before criticizing federal regulators. Centennial was a high-flying organization that was headed for trouble for a long time," unquote. And again, one of the questions I'm asking here is there a connection between the Centennial, between Bosco's going to bat for Centennial, and Bosco's going to bat for John Hull in the drug tug case installment one, as well as in the second installment of the CIA-SNL connection. We took a look at Doug Bosco's letter, along with 16 other congressmen, to President Arias of Costa Rica, urging leniency for John Hull in their investigations of John Hull. It was done between the lines, but it was pretty clear what was going on. And again, I'm not making the statement, yes, ipso facto, these are connected. I'm asking the question, are they connected? Is there a connection between the drug tug case, LendVest, the Centennial Savings and Loan, which intersects both with Charles Duck and U.S. Attorney Peter Robinson? Is there a connection between Sid Shaw, the drug smuggling operation he was involved in, Centennial, the drug tug LendVest case that we're looking at? Obviously, we can't say that these are the same situation. At the same time, it's obvious that there are connecting links between them, and there are similarities between the types of operations we're seeing. Certainly the chicanery at LendVest and the chicanery at Centennial are similar. And by the same token, we're seeing a drug smuggling operation, the drug tug case, in connection with LendVest. And we're seeing the same kind of an operation in connection with Centennial. I'm wondering, given the apparent connections between John Hull's operation and also the drug tug case, and given the apparently kind attitude of Doug Bosco to John Hull, at least he was a signatory to the letter to President Arias, are there connections between these things? And again, it's not a statement I'm making. It's a question I'm asking, food for thought and grounds for further research. And again, knowing something about why the information is being leaked or who's leaking the information to Harry Martin about the drug tug case, and again, information is being leaked to him, I have a hunch that there is a strong connection between the two articles I'm about to read. They both appeared, and I've read this before and read this into this series before, both appear on the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle on Christmas Day for 1989. The headline, and I'm only going to read the headline for the lead story, Noriega asks asylum, he surrenders to Vatican envoy. U.S. troops ring papal embassy, state line Panama City, Chronicle wire services. Obviously, Noriega turned up alive and well at this same time. Two of the Lenvest people were pulled in at the same time. On the other side of the page, again the front page of the Chronicle for Christmas Day, we find the second most important article, at least according to the way the articles are arranged. Over at the left-hand side of the page, we find the following headline, Two Businessmen in Napa Face Fraud Charges. That's by Tessa DiCarlo, Chronicle correspondent, and it reads in part as follows. One Napa businessman is in jail, and another is being sought by police on hundreds of charges of theft and fraud involving companies linked to a record-breaking marijuana and hashish seizure in May of 1988. David Hansen, the former president of Lenvest Mortgage Incorporated, was being held yesterday in Napa County Jail on $1 million bail while investigators looked for Robert Pittner, former managing general partner of the Joseph Matthews Winery. According to a report filed with the indictment, Lenvest, once Napa County's fastest-growing mortgage firm, supplied millions of dollars to the lavishly restored historic winery in downtown Napa. The mortgage company and the winery went bankrupt after federal investigators linked them to a barge discovered in San Francisco Bay on May 24, 1988, loaded with 57 tons of marijuana and hashish, skipping down. The Napa indictments, which were filed Friday, are the first attempt to press charges involving the millions of dollars that investors lost after Lenvest and Joseph Matthews went bust. Quote, "It was a very complex case, and it's going to be expensive and cost a tremendous amount of local court time," unquote, said Napa District Attorney Jerome Mautner. "We didn't really have the ability to do this, but we did it anyway." My opinion is that the people here had to be brought in and prevented from making deals with prosecutors or making deals with people on their own. I believe, and I can't prove it, but I believe that's why we saw these two people being hauled in at the same time as Noriega turns up alive and well, because Noriega, obviously, as we've looked at in so many of the programs we've done connected to there about the Iran-Contra scandal, Noriega in a position to disclose a lot of information about George Bush and our national security establishment's involvement with the drug trade. And the drug tug case in particular is heavily involved with Noriega, and obviously it also involves, at least according to the information presented by the Sentinel, John Hull as well. It's my feeling that these two individuals were a risk when they were at large, and that basically they had to be hauled in at this time so they couldn't be walking around making deals with federal investigators or simply disappearing. They had, in a sense, like the linebackers that I talked about in the December surprise, and the December surprise program I did, they had to be frozen. That is to say, they had to be kept track of, and a prosecution, a limited prosecution in this case probably, had to be begun, and they had to be silenced. My guess is once these two people were in prison, given the fate of people like Irv Hansen, given the fate of people like Kenneth Armitage and others, they would be inclined to say only what was in their best interest to say, and would not be inclined to talk too much about some of the things that they might disclose. How much information David Hansen and Robert Pittner had, whether that information could have further damaged U.S. national security interests, as the information that Noriega undoubtedly had could have, remains to be seen. But again, that, in my opinion, from what I know about this case, this is why, basically, the two individuals had to be hauled in when Noriega turned up alive and well, because the drug tug case, from what I know, has explosive possibilities, and a cover-up was necessitated at this time, and I think, I can't prove it, but I think that's why these two individuals had to be hauled in. They were too dangerous to be allowed running around loose where they could talk to investigators, start making deals on their own. We're going to take the last of tonight's musical breaks, and then we're going to come back and we're going to take a look at other disturbing indications of an impending cover-up of the drug tug case, of the CIA connection to the SNL case, and we're going to look at evidence of cover-up of the SNL crisis in general.